You're listening to Carrie Lutz's Financial Survival Network, where you get valuable information you just can't find anywhere else. To thrive in today's trying times, you need the Financial Survival Network, now more than ever. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and get your free newsletter and gift. Financial Survival Network, now more than ever.
And welcome. You are listening to watching the Financial Survival Network. I'm Carrie Lutz. Well, real estate has certainly been one of the best performing asset classes, especially during the pandemic. Is it going to continue, or are we going to see a pullback? And what choices do you really have? We've got with us now real estate expert Mark Hamilton. Mark, you've been at this game a long time. Your firm's got an investment portfolio worth over $4 billion, 20,000 apartment units. So you're obviously somebody who knows from whence he speaks. And looking at the current real estate market, obviously there's not one real estate market in the country. There are multiples, hundreds really. And you can't make a blanket statement about one market that applies to all the others. But at the present time, we're seeing interest rates going higher and perhaps demand easing off a bit. What's your take on the real estate market now on a global, national level?
You make a very good point, Carrie, that real estate is a local business. It's local for operators. Unless you own triple net properties, single tenant, it's going to be a local business. There's going to be a lot of care and feeding involved, whether it's shopping centers, office properties, apartments, what have you. From the pandemic, we've seen performance differ market to market. Some performance has been quite strong. Some performance has gone backwards. Nationally, or on the macro level, what I would say is that in March and April of 2020, we were concerned that values might get hurt, that what we would have would be a COVID discount on pricing, and cap rates would go up, rates of return would go up. What we saw instead was that the market kind of went into paralysis for maybe 90 days. Really nothing happened. Lenders were very protective. They started including reserves and impounds at the beginning for 12 months. They gradually walked that back to 9, then they walked it back to 6. And I think the reserves are pretty much in the reserve requirement is pretty much in the rearview mirror right now. But what we saw instead, when the dust settled, is that there was actually a COVID premium. Interest rates went down. We all know that the Fed intervened. And by then we could see people on the move. In San Francisco, probably Boston, New York for sure, LA. If it was new and sleek and vertical and infill, it struggled. Occupancy went down. People decided they didn't want to be parking their cars in garages, going up into lobbies, going up into elevators, going up into hallways. If something had its own front door, the value went up. People went to the suburbs. They went to the exurbs. They went far and wide. And we used to be, very long ago, we were an urban operator in San Francisco and Oakland. And values on that got to a point where we weren't seeing the cash flow that we wanted. So we went to a suburban model, a distributed suburban model, and we're nationwide at this point in time. And so there was a real disconnect. If you were new and sleek and urban, you probably, as a seller, probably were paralyzed because occupancy went way down. If you were a CC minus property, landlord, you got hurt again because delinquency went way up. Collections were way off. If you were a B to B plus, A minus landlord, which is what we are, you rode out the worst of it. And then we started having income gains. We're in a number of markets where the income gains have been significant. I think every one of our markets, we're in 16 or 17 states and 27 or 28 markets. And every one of our markets, rents climbed, some of them dramatically. And because of that, cap rates went down. You know, people were willing to pay more. Prices went up, rates of return went down. And so on a macro level, it's still probably sorting out between you know, what's happening with the super A plus properties and what's happening with the C minus properties. But if you're, you know, if you're a value alternative to the A stuff, have nice real estate and are suburban, you're definitely buying in a compressed cap rate environment where, you know, we're struggling to find a 4% return right now. Financing costs have come back up a little bit, but I also think that there's an expectation nationwide for a resurgence in household formation. About a year ago, maybe 9 months ago, we saw some media that the number of millennials domiciled back at home with mom and dad or a brother or a sister or a family member, one thing or another, doubled up, was at an all-time high, both in absolute terms and as a percentage. So for us, that's latent household formation. I'm sure everybody looked at it that way. And then there's also, let's face it, inflation is a real thing right now. And rents are going up as part of inflation. And so if you can lock in long-term fixed rate debt and buy good real estate and look at household formation and some more modest, more manageable version of inflation, then real estate looks good. Again, it's sector by sector. Shopping centers, people are going to be careful. Hospitality, restaurants, hotels, people are going to be careful. Urban infill, office, or apartments, you know, the glittering stuff, people are going to be careful. But if it's stable, which some suburban office is, a lot of multi-tenant industrial is, apartments and the like, there's strong demand. We don't follow student that closely, but I suspect that student is most of the way recovered. And we're also seeing a lot of opportunity in what they call the active adult property type, which is 55 plus, but light on services, not a care facility, but more something that would be conducive to a lock and leave lifestyle. And then otherwise, it's just, you know, it's the compression of returns that's happened over the last 40 years that certainly helps make real estate sector by sector or case by case a compelling investment strategy.
Interesting. And so obviously you have to be wary of where you put your money, these urban markets. I mean, they're all higher, like even New York City, Boston, all have gone up. But with rising rates, that could reverse quickly. But southern markets definitely appear to be stronger than northern, right?
Sun Belt is very strong. Far and away, the biggest cohort of the migration went to the Sun Belt. People went elsewhere. People went to the Mountain West and the like. But people largely left expensive parts of the coast and went to the Sun Belt or went to the Mountain West or went wherever. It's a good time to be careful, but opportunities there. And, you know, we also saw, or I think we're seeing right now in some of the eastern markets, I'll just say New York, for example, that people are coming back, right? I don't live there. I don't know that we can quite call it a resurgence, but people are coming back into New York City and I think Boston. I won't say they're acting like it never like the pandemic never happened, but I think rents, I saw something last week that indicated that rents have recovered the vast majority of what they lost in New York City. It's a little slower out here in California. We're a little more locked down.
Yeah, but mentioning rents, so in the Sun Belt, rents are still extremely strong, aren't they?
No question. We've seen in Arizona, we've seen a 30% increase in rents over the last couple of years. That's a lot. You know, if you're talking about a $1,500 rent, well, that rent is now $1,950 to $2,000. And that's, you know, that's people with different wage levels moving in and shrugging off a $2,000 rent and feeling like they get a good apartment deal.
So you've been at this game a long time here, Mark. Mm-hmm. Yep. And when you see household formations in a particular market start to really go up strongly, invariably rents, returns, etc., are going to climb with them, aren't they?
Don't just survive, thrive. The Financial Survival Network.
Silver One Resources is an exploration and development company backed by strategic investors Eric Sprott and SSR Mining. At Silver One's Candelaria Mine project in Nevada, there is already a historic resource estimated at 127 million ounces of silver, which Silver One is developing and advancing. The company's Phoenix Silver project, located within the Arizona Silver Belt, is an early-stage exploration project on which native silver vein fragments have been discovered near surface. One grab sample assay an astounding 14,688 ounces per ton. Yes, that's right, ounces, not grams. Silver One has tremendous exploration potential, is extremely leveraged to the price of silver, and is cashed up and poised to increase shareholder value. Silver One trades in New York under the ticker SLVRF and in Toronto under the ticker SVE. To learn more, go to silverone.com. That's silverone.com.
This is the Financial Survival Network, the information you need to thrive now more than ever.
Absolutely. And I also think that the work from home environment and the telecommuting opportunity that many people have, you know, people were able to leave high cost, high rent areas and move to markets that were a little more conducive to what they wanted in their lifestyle and pay a lower rent. And so because of that, you know, with those high wages coming in, and with whatever baked in growth was to be found in any particular market, we're seeing rents go up in a lot of places.
Hey, well, I know, like for myself, one of my children, her and her husband were living in Manhattan. Pandemic hits. They basically went to all remote all the time. And they moved up to Denver, so they got like much lower cost, lower taxes, and better lifestyle. They can go skiing whenever they like. So that's just close to home, what I've seen. So, but we've seen such rapid appreciation. A lot of you out there are going to be looking to sell your properties, and that's where the 1031 exchange program really comes into play. And I know you're an expert in it, Mark. First, just briefly explain for those of you out there who aren't perhaps fully familiar with 1031 exchange, how does that work?
So if you're if you own investment property, and there's no specific type of property that it has to be, it just has to be property held for investment, which for many of us will be income reported on Schedule E. Or it could be you might be in a partnership, in which case you'd get your income reported on a K-1. But if the real estate has been held for investment, we tend to think 2 years, but the code is not clear on that. And a lot of people will tell you that you only have to hold it for a day. But with that said, with guidance from your own tax expert, if you have real estate that's been held for investment and you sell it, and when you close your sale, your disposition, you arrange with the title company to have the funds held with an exchange accommodator. And that's most of what they do, is hold your funds. They process the appropriate documents and paperwork. But your funds will be held by an exchange accommodator. And per the rules, you need to identify property that you'd like to acquire as your replacement property. And that's what it's called. It's called a replacement property. We also refer to it as an up leg, with your sale being the down leg. But you need to identify the property you're going to purchase within 45 days. And then you need to close the acquisition within another 135 days. So 45 days to designate, 180 days gate to gate. And the IRS will consider for tax purposes, they'll effectively consider that you haven't had a sale that produces a capital gains tax at that time. It defers the tax. If you go all the way and take it into your estate, then it becomes part of your estate. But in the short term, you're going to defer the capital gains tax that you would have on any profit that you might make. You will also defer the what's called a recapture tax, which is the taxation on depreciation, basically, on any offsets to your investment basis that you used to save money on your income taxes. And so it's very tax efficient strategy. In the long run, we understand that really only 1 out of 10 or 2 out of 10 investors will do multiple exchanges. The number of investors who go beyond 2 or 3 exchanges without liquidating is very small. But for those that wish to keep their equity tied up and untaxed, it's very tax efficient. Any CPA or tax lawyer would be able to help an investor know more about it, know more about how to do it. A title company in California, we use title companies. I know in some parts of the East, they use attorneys for closing. But any good closing resource will be able to help somebody find an exchange accommodator. And our experience has been that it's quite safe. You're trusting a third party with your money. So you want to find someone who is reputable and has an active business. And my thought would be, if you're getting a recommendation from a CPA or a tax lawyer that you trust, and you're getting a recommendation from a closer or a title company that you could trust, then you should feel safe. And it allows you to resume ownership in an asset that at that point in time is more to your liking. You can also go in with a sponsor such as us. There are others that do the same work that we do. And there are a number of different investment strategies that an investor could follow to acquire their replacement property. They could buy on their own. They could buy in what's called a Delaware statutory trust, which is most likely going to be arranged by a sponsor such as us. You could do a tenancy in common structure with other people to own a piece of real estate. And you can also probably bypass the 1031 altogether with what's called an UPREIT strategy. So if you're thinking about selling a property that it's just time to let go of, it's a good opportunity to get guidance on strategies for replacement, especially if you're not ready to pay the capital gains tax.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. And it's not overly complex. It sounds a lot more complex the way you're describing it, but it's fairly simple, literally docu-signing some forms.
That's pretty close. I mean, people would tell you it's a little more involved than that. Anybody's going to tell you that if you're going to sign a document, you should read it, right? And these are legal documents. But I think transactionally, you're selling a property, the disposition aspect is going to be basically the same, right? So you're going to go through whatever process you're going to go through regardless, just to dispose of your real estate. And if you're going to effect an exchange, then there is a little more process involved. You have to make sure you follow the footwork closely. And then it's just basically a resumption of management. You reload your management, whether you're doing it yourself or outsourcing it to someone like us. And I think a lot of investors specifically sell real estate and go in with sponsors because they're ready to be done with it, right? They don't want to pay their gains, but they've enjoyed the real estate. They want to continue to have real estate in their portfolio. And they really basically want to outsource all of the management so that you're responsible for, as an investor, you're responsible for collecting your check or your wire once a month or once a quarter, looking at reports as often as you want them, and filing your tax return. Filing a return for the income, and it becomes much simpler. And I do think that's a big part of why people exchange. Getting away from the headaches is certainly a big part of why people sell investment property.
And you're free to take some of your profits at that point, pay the taxes, and reinvest the remainder of it. I think they call it a boot or something like that.
Yep.
Yeah.
So, that's accurate.
So, and from your standpoint, they're just investing in one of your funds. Is that how that works, or particular?
Well, I think for most people who do an exchange, and it's not a one-to-one exchange of a rental condo for a rental condo, and who go and who choose to engage a sponsor such as us, you're going to invest. You're either going to invest in a tenancy in common structure, which, for example, if you and Nicole and I decided to buy a property together and we didn't want to form a partnership, we wanted to each own our own undivided interest in the real estate. We could do that together. That's called a tenancy in common structure. You can also do what's called an UPREIT, which I know less about. But there are sponsors that will allow investors to contribute their real estate to their REIT through what's called an UPREIT. And then you basically own shares in the REIT. And again, that's been deemed by the IRS to be a satisfactory exchange. I think far and wide, most people will probably go into a Delaware statutory trust. And it satisfies the IRS that you've bought real estate. But as an investor, what you need to make sure of is that you're not selling real estate and buying and directly buying shares in something, because in that case, you're selling real estate and buying personal property, and that will expose you to a capital gains tax. So if, you know, all of the above that we've mentioned can be done to satisfy that it's a like-kind replacement, and that it's not a capital gains event. But if you sell real estate and then just invest it into a fund, like maybe one of the big funds that come out of New York, that will be a sale of real estate and a purchase of stock, which is personal property, which will expose to the gain.
Yeah. So you've got to effectively at an UPREIT, you got to exchange, give your property into the REIT, and then you take back shares in the REIT. So it's considered the exchange, and it falls under 1031. That makes a lot of sense. We've talked about them here before. I think a lot of you out there are going to want to know more. Mark, how do we connect with you on the web? How do we find out?
I will say that our website tells our story pretty well. It's HamiltonZanz.com, HamiltonZanz.com. You can find some useful information there and get a better sense of the firm and our investment strategy. If for any reason people want to reach out to me directly, my email is mark@HamiltonZanz.com.
All right. Excellent. Well, we appreciate you coming on. We'll have a link, as always, in the show notes to this interview on financialsurvivalnetwork.com. If you got a question for Mark, you can always shoot me an email direct. We'll get you an answer. KL@CarrieLutz.com. Don't forget, when you go to the site, sign up for your free newsletter. Mark, pleasure having you on. Thank you so much. And I'm sure we'll talk to you again.
Thanks for having me. It's good to talk to you.
Thanks for listening to Carrie Lutz's Financial Survival Network, your solution to today's trying times. For the latest, go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com. Financial Survival Network, now more than ever.